Carla White. I am a project officer and health education specialist in the Division of Reproductive Health at Centers for Disease Control on the Adolescent Reproductive Health team. And two of our project partners are here today, Miriam Hernandez-Jennings, who's the director of the New England Training Center for Adolescent Pregnancy Prevention, and Bridget Riley, who is the executive director of the Minnesota Organization for Adolescent Parenting Prevention and Pregnancy. I think I got that right. MOAT. Okay, and if I could please ask you, if you have any questions for clarification during each presentation, please go ahead and ask questions for discussion. We'd like to hold to the end just to make sure that each presenter has equal opportunity to get through everything in their 20 minutes that they have allotted. And great, so I will go ahead. Thanks. We have at CDC a cooperative agreement entitled Promoting Science-Based Approaches to Prevent Teen Pregnancy, HIV, and STDs. And today our presentations will be focusing on some of the, I'll give you background on the project, and then Miriam and Bridget will give you some specific examples of some things that are going on with the project. What I wanted to accomplish here today is for you all to give you an understanding of the definition of science-based approaches and programs to teen pregnancy, STD, and HIV prevention, to talk about why this is a capacity-building project versus purely an implementation. We're not simply giving money straight to local organizations to implement programs, but we're making an effort to build capacity, which we've worked some, actually arduously, to define for using science-based approaches. And then Bridget and Miriam will be talking about some of the partnerships and policy changes that have occurred in their areas. As is well known, U.S. has seen a substantial decline in teen birth rates over the past 15 years. In 2004, the overall teen birth rate was 41.1 live births per 1,000 women aged 15 to 19. Of course, there are vast disparities within our teen birth rates. By state and territory, Washington, D.C. had the highest rate in 2004 of 66.7%. It was just in the news the other day how much their teen pregnancy rate has dropped, which is great. And then Texas and Guam, if we include the territories, came in second place tied at 62.6 teen birth rate. With New Hampshire being the lowest at 18.2, so there's quite a spread there. And you can see there's a pattern there on the bottom, with the dark blue states having the highest teen pregnancy rates, birth rates. And this breakdown I like because it tells more of a story here. You can see that as many of you probably know, non-Hispanic black teen females have experienced a very, very substantial decline in their pregnancy and birth rates. They currently still have the highest pregnancy rate, but Hispanic young females have the highest birth rate. I don't know the breakdown, maybe some of you do, but I don't know how many of the abortions included are therapeutic versus spontaneous abortions. So that's certainly playing a role there. But it's interesting to know because we often report birth rates. I'm sorry. Yes, you have a question? Okay, great. Thank you. Okay. Okay. Oh, fetal loss on the top. Yes, thank you, of course. Thanks for the clarification. And in 2004... here we can see that the birth rates per 1,000 females aged 15 and 19 are highest with Hispanic young women. And actually, Martin, in this report, also had some information on male rates. And the numbers will be lower for reporting issues, but I put them here because it's interesting to see how the shape mirrors the shape of the bars for the females in the red. We often talk about our project just as a teen pregnancy prevention project, but we definitely don't want STDs and HIV to get lost in that. Chlamydia rate, the case rate per 100,000 population of females in 2005 was more than 3 times higher than for males, much of that reflecting the fact that women are more likely to be screened than young men. Females aged 15 to 19 had the highest chlamydia rate at close to 3,000, followed by females in 20 to 24-year-old age group under 3,000, I mean a little under that. African-American women in 2005 had about more than 7 times the chlamydia rate of white females, so there's certainly a disparity there, and more than twice that of Hispanic females. American Indian and Alaska Native women had the second highest rate per 100,000 population, and the rate among Asian Pacific Island women was the lowest. Just to point out also the importance of adolescence as a time to address issues of sexuality and safe sex practices, you can see the tremendous leap in positive diagnoses of HIV between leaping up between the 13 to 14 age group and then the 15 to 19-year-olds. Unfortunately, we don't have maybe the Stoneman notes, but a further breakdown of the ages. And I believe that the majority of those cases are among young men having unprotected sex with men. I don't think John Santelli's in the room, but he had his, maybe some of you saw his poster yesterday. What's behind the downward trend, and this is where the science-based aspect comes in, is what's been causing, what's been driving the downward trend in pregnancy rates. And Santelli et al., just this year, came out using the National Survey of Family Growth data on 15 to 19-year-olds. They had a follow-up from their 1995 and then looked at 2002, and they found that about 14% of the decline was due to a decrease in the percentage of sexually active women, age 15 to 19, and 86% was due to increased contraceptive use. Among 15 to 17-year-olds, 23% of the decline they found was due to the decline in the percentage of sexually active young women, with 77% due to increased contraceptive use. Among 18 and 19-year-olds, all change was due to increased contraceptive use. So that that knowing that the 23% of the decline being due to delaying sexual activity among 15 to 17-year-olds is important to know. So in 2005, Congress gave CDC funding with the purpose of doing what it could to promote science-based approaches to prevent teen pregnancy. And I wasn't around at the time for the fun, but I'm sure that this was a rowdy bunch of meetings to decide what we meant by a science-based approach and how we even came up with the term science-based versus evidence-based versus programs at work. Generally, they all mean the same thing, but this we had to find some very specific definitions to in order for to get going with our project. Using science-based approaches, we consider using demographic, epidemiological, and social science research to identify populations at risk and also to identify risk and protective factors within those populations. To use health education, health and health behavior theory, to decide to select what risk and protective factors you want to address by the program you're going to implement, to use a logic model to link those factors with program strategies and outcomes, and then selecting and adapting if necessary, depending on the population you're working with, and implementing the program, and then finally conducting process and outcome evaluation and making changes and program improvements based on that. That's science-based approach. So once you've selected a program, what do we mean by a science-based program? The Division of Reproductive Health at CDC doesn't directly identify, we don't do the work. We don't identify specific interventions or programs. We don't recommend or promote a specific program over all others. What we've done is establish criteria to determine the rigor of study design used to evaluate programs, and our national grantees that I will be speaking about in a minute have established lists of science-based programs, and we steer project partners to those lists so that they can go through, see what risk and behavior factors those programs have been shown to be effective in addressing and fit the program to their particular population of youth that they want to serve. What we mean by evaluated with a rigorous design, as much as we could demand in the field right now, because we all feel unsatisfied with the extent of evaluations done. I think that's a chronic condition. But that an experimental or quasi-experimental design was used, that knowledge, attitude, and behavior were used as outcomes that were looked at in the evaluation. There was an adequate sample size. There are some sort of follow-up data available, so it wasn't just immediately when the program finished, so you see change in knowledge, but, you know, 6 months, a year later, what was the behavior? And then the tough one is that we want programs where the results have been published in a peer-reviewed journal. So some programs are really struggling just with that one aspect, because sometimes it can be hard to get published. The two of our national grantees that we fund through this project, the National Campaign to Prevent Teen Pregnancy and Advocates for Youth, are the ones that are the main sources for our list of programs that are being implemented through this project. The National Campaign uses Kirby's definition of programs that work as it peers and emerging answers, and that's easily available online if you need to look it up. The criteria are that research was done in the U.S. or Canada in 1980 or later, and this is a new version of Emergency Answers just came out, so this is from the original one. Target populations were 12 to 18-year-olds. There are follow-up data, and impact on behavior was shown. There were at least 100 people in treatment and control groups. Two or more evaluations have been completed. Desired outcomes: reduced primary pregnancy, HIV, or STD rates in teens. The campaign relies on the authors of Emerging Answers and doesn't do their own reviews. And Kirby's 2007 update was actually just released a week ago. Tomorrow. How prescient of me. I'm sorry. Nobody told me I was behind. Okay. Advocates for Youth uses our definition, except they specify that a program, in order to end up on their list, must show to result in at least two sexual health-related behaviors. They first issued a list of programs at work in 2003, which included 16 curricula and three youth development programs. In 2006, they added five new programs, four of which were clinical, which is nice because some of our grantees are asking about that. They do the research there. They basically evaluate the strength of the evaluations. They have some serious researchers on their staff. If they don't feel comfortable with their own knowledge, they will farm it out to other professional evaluators. Their work is not funded through our project, like Emerging Answers has been, but their list is a primary source. So this is just an example of advocates' list, where across the top you'll see the behavioral outcomes that were looked at, and the star indicates the list of programs on the left, and then each star indicates which program had a positive effect on which behavioral outcome. The programs added in 2006 were all clinical except for Teen Star, which is a school-based. We also, a lot of local organizations already have a program up and running, and they might have funding for that program. So if they're interested in working with our state coalitions, we don't want them to just throw everything toss it all out the window. We need to respect that. And so what we have them do in that situation is work with our state coalitions to assess those programs for the 17 characteristics of effective programs that Kirby developed. The result of this is that there are many programs and many lists. There's a lot of overlap. We at CDC have a lot of lists ourselves that I think where programs have been looked through using different lenses. You know, the folks in HIV will evaluate programs that prevent HIV, so there will be a tremendous amount of overlap. But some slight differences, and I think one of the differences with ours is that we're specifically looking at behavioral outcomes, and not only did, you know, rates decrease. Some of the gaps that we feel aware of and that we would like to fix and slowly are working on addressing in using this approach is promising programs, like I mentioned, can be perfectly good, very effective programs and don't make it to the list, you know, which is frustrating for them. Youth development programs we're very interested in. Teen outreach program and career, I think right now, are the only two that we have that have been evaluated sufficiently in how well they address reproductive health-related behaviors. Clinical programs, secondary teen pregnancy prevention, pregnant and parenting teens, a lot of our states and local organizations are interested in that population of youth. And, of course, preventing a second pregnancy for a teen can have tremendous benefits to the outcomes of her life and the child. And then also, many of these have not been evaluated for replication in diverse populations based on race and ethnicity. We are getting requests from some of our states more and more often about how to make sure that programs are friendly to lesbian, gay, bisexual questioning youth. That's going to be an interesting adaptation challenge. Youth in foster care, that's another population that is very popular among our grantees. So, for our project here, the purpose is to increase the capacity of state and local organizations to use science-based approaches to promote those among their local organizations. The way that the project is structured is we fund 3 national organizations, 9 state teen pregnancy coalitions, no health departments at this time, and 4 Title X regional training centers. We do not fund the youth-serving local organizations directly. We fund the top 2 boxes instead, and they work to build capacity, respectively, at the state and the local level through trainings on evaluation, how to do a logic model, how to select a program that fits your population of youth, how to do a needs assessment, what are the risk factors that you want to address, and so forth. Dissemination and implementation, you'll be getting a good taste of from Miriam and Bridget. On some levels, we work with decision makers, funders, to build awareness of the need for science-based approaches, first to build sort of external environmental support, and then increasing capacity at the local level, which we've defined here, which I, for the sake of time, I won't go through the list, but has to do with, you know, knowledge, awareness, using the information for evaluation and so forth. At the local level, an important piece of our capacity building is to use the Getting to Outcomes model developed by Abe Wandersman and others at University of South Carolina, which really walks, and I think that this is very good for local organizations that have a wide variety of educational and training levels, but it really walks the organization with a nice, easy-to-use set of tools through 10 steps of program design, quality improvement, evaluation, sustainability, and so forth. It's coming in very, very useful, and it's working out well. So for our evaluation, what we're hoping to see is increased number of local organizations that have implemented and can sustain their program, more youth served by programs that work. This could be, hopefully, a model for lower cost capacity building, dissemination, implementation. The total project budget, I believe, is $6 million. And we're halfway through the project now, starting in 2005, ends in 2010, and we're getting a lot of bang for our buck out of the coalitions and our partners. Initially, we had not provided implementation funds for the local organizations, and while we still don't fund them directly, that was turning out to be a tremendous barrier for our project grantees to get the local organizations on board, understandably, of course. They needed something to buy curricula with and